Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and it's my great pleasure to be sitting across from Judy Nunn. Welcome, Judy.
G'day, John. Again, hi.
We're here to talk about Sanctuary, your new book.
We are.
And you know, this is one of those things that, you know, as a bookseller, I love a Judy Nunn year. It's always a good year when a Judy Nunn
book. As a writer, I love you, a bookseller, loving a Judy Nunn year.
But readers out there must be going, come on, Judy, what are you doing? Give me 2 years to wait. What's going on? Do you get a lot of responses from eager readers going, can you speed it up a little?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah. Actually, that's funny. I really do, which, of course, is utterly disarming. But then I say, no, honestly, for me anyway, I mean, I'm lost in admiration for writers who can bring a book out every year, some of 2 a year or, you know. For me, I think I'd get... If I felt that amount of pressure on myself, I think I'd probably find the easy way, thinking, oh, well, I might self-plagiarise a little bit. Well, that worked last time. I'll swing it that way or whatever. I really like to set myself a task that, look, I might not be setting the bar higher, but I'm certainly setting the bar in a different way. I come at a book with a different tack, or I pick maybe a very controversial subject matter, as in Sanctuary, as in a book like Maralinga, you know, eponymously named after the nuclear testing site. So something that will excite me, because I believe that if I'm excited as I write, then what I'm writing will excite the readers.
Your last couple of books, Eliane and Spirit of the Garn, very different.
And this
new book, Sanctuary, is very different again. Can you give us a little tiny little bit of a sneak preview of what's in Sanctuary?
Yes, indeed, of course. It is a contemporary novel, whereas my most recent... Well, actually, no, the last one, Spirits of the Garn, was actually contemporary in the way that it was in the early-ish 2000s, which I call contemporary. Yeah. Many of my other books have been historically based back in the Snowy Mountains, hydroelectric scheme days of immigration or something like that. This one is contemporary, and it is about a small group of people seeking refuge... and they're the sole survivors of a shipwreck. And they actually, closer to death than still alive, find themselves on this remote island that, strangely enough, although it's deserted of people, there are huts there, and there is all the wherewithal for their survival. So they're nine people in all, a small boy and eight adults. And it becomes their utopian place where, having fled these terrible conflict in the Middle East, they're all from Middle Eastern countries, that they're sort of reborn, and they have to, in order to survive, they're of different backgrounds, different cultures, different religions, these eight adults, they need to bond, and they become this sort of family. But of course, you know, good things can't last, and they will be discovered. They don't even know where their island is. So the whole thing is dum-da-dum-dum. What will happen with it when they're discovered? And we discover, of course, the background and the fact that these people are above all. They're people. You really get to know these characters, as well as the characters of the township where they don't realise, nearby, 40 k's off on the coast.
So is that how you prevent... Because this, it sounds like to me you're waiting... confidently into a very turbulent political sea.
Yes. Not that confidently. It took me several years to build up the confidence for this.
But that human story is where you turn to separate yourself. I mean, this is a very complex moment in history. You're taking on contemporary issues in a world that is changing for some things beyond our recognition.
Yes.
And to boldly... walk into this. What were the things that you how did you manage to walk through the minefield to find the human story? Because there's so many political points of view and so many prejudices and so many things going on
But the thing is, John, I deliberately have avoided, as narrator, the narrator's voice, making any political statements whatsoever.
Yep.
I don't become political. I happen to be dealing with desperate people near death who need to survive, who do indeed bond for that sake, where there would originally perhaps have been some antipathy between them. Mm-hmm. You need to when your life is at stake. Then the people in the township become a microcosm of Australia and its views and the people of Australia's views. There are for, there are against, there is statements of government policy in place, mm-hmm. there's all of these different points of view, but they're coming from the characters within the book.
Yeah.
I don't want my book to make any statement. It's about people, and in it being about people, you do get to know not only these people seeking refuge, yeah. but the people whose points of view may indeed be changing themselves, And of course, word will get out. Yeah. You can't keep something like this a secret forever. So there are comments made by my characters in the book on government policy, this, that, for, against, but it's none of it is me.
Interesting. Many authors who take on such things have to get into the brains of people they may not agree with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And walking a few miles in their shoes can often bring an author to recognise why people believe in certain things which they don't believe in. And do you find that experience with this book?
Absolutely, undoubtedly. Now, that's the same thing. I mean, if you're going to write about a psychopath or something, yeah. You're going to have to get into their heads. Mm. Part of you becomes a bit psychopathic yourself. but there may be reasons that people do the most unforgivable things, but there are triggers, and you have to get inside there. It's the same thing with acting. I've been spending all my life before, now I'm an author beyond yeah. all else. But the study of human beings, the study of the human condition, the study above all of relationships, how people relate or fail to relate, you change your characters, actually change you while you're writing.
It's interesting that there are writers who have spent many years acting, and they're sort of crossing mm. over. It is an interesting university for writers to have to take on physically and all the mannerisms and the whole deal characters. I mean, David Williams is his Little Britain and to those yeah. weird little characters, and now he writes these successful kids' books. Pops to mind straight away as someone who's sort of is able to translate. So you're with this book, this is the island isn't kind of placed. What was the inspiration for the island? Is there a locale somewhere in the back of your imagination for this?
Absolutely, there is, and I have talked of this before. On even though this is very early days, and the people I'm chatting to now are getting a very early insight into, without a doubt, the specific island is what you'd call a paper island. It doesn't actually exist. It is fictitious, as is my coastal town. But the inspiration certainly came from a general location, and that is the Abrolhos Islands off the coast of Western Australia, about 70 k's from the coastal township of Geraldton, although Geraldton, of course, is a large city.
Yeah.
Historically, very interesting, and the Abrolhos Islands, of course, are—they're really—it's a whole archipelago of islands that are infamous historically for the early Dutch and Portuguese shipwrecks. Mm-hmm. Most famous of all, of course, the Batavia, which has always fascinated me. So they're really no more than lightly vegetated reefs, really. So they're very dangerous and very impossible, difficult to see. In big seas back in, so the Batavia wreck there in 1629, I've always found this area and the Abrolhos above all absolutely fascinating. And I was doing a writers' festival, my husband Bruce and I were doing a writers' festival called the Big Sky Festival at Geraldton. Terrific festival, beautiful librarians running it, very good. And they offered these visiting writers, those who wanted to put their hand up, to spend a night on the Abrolhos, one of the Abrolhos Islands, an island specifically called Big Rat, actually. Naturally, my hand shot up because nobody's allowed to stay overnight there. Bruce and I had hired a plane when I was researching for, because I've used the Batavia in a number of my novels before, and we'd hired a plane, charter plane, and we'd landed there and explored for the day, but that's all you're allowed. And with the permission of the Department of Fisheries, these half dozen writers were flown over there, put up overnight. The fisheries guys, their wives made us this. They didn't come, but the fisheries blokes were there to show us around and all of this, and stayed in these sort of little military donga type things set up for the scientists who visit the island and for environmental purposes and things. And so the wives had made up the big bowls of prawns and salads, and we all sat around exchanging these amazing stories about, because it is so bleak, it is so desolate, it is so incredible. And there are these little sort of empty huts there that you'd think, whoa, where am I? I'm in the middle of nowhere. You can watch the sun set and then you can watch the sun rise. You're on this barren little rocky reef. So it was so inspirational. And it was actually Bruce who said to me as we were coming back, he said, you know, instead of some Agatha Christie murder thing like we're all talking about, and we're all shrieking about the thought, he said, you know, imagine what if a boatload of refugees arrived here and there was nothing there but these little huts that contained. And I said, darling, you go there, too political for me. Yeah. I mean, they, you know. And then it was only a couple of that stayed with me, the imagery of people near death landing there, not knowing where they are. What water am I in? Am I in Australian waters or still in Indonesian waters? After the storm, they have no idea. So I couldn't leave that opening scene alone. And once you've got the start of a book, I've always said this, once you've got the start of a book, the book has to write itself. No matter how hard the work is, heck of a lot of research and painful research. I mean, really researching the areas from whence these people had come and what they'd been through. Harrowing. And talking to a couple of dear refugee people who were very open with me. Unbelievable backgrounds. So I've written about war zones before. I mean, I've written quite a deal of World War I in several novels, World War II. I've gone to Vietnam in a couple of my books. I always find it very, very harrowing writing about conflict. But it's this is what my people have been through. It's what my people went through in Cal when they came back from World War I, or what they went through in Tigerman when they went to World War II, or, you know. So it actually is inspirational as well as being harrowing, because that's what forms the characters. And all of my books are very character-driven. I love working above all else on character.
Yeah, it seems strange that Australia would have a policy to keep out people who have fought so hard. Like, these are character-filled people, you know. Yeah. And part, these people in you're talking about after the First World War and the Second World War were the people who rolled up their sleeves and got things done, these waves of immigrants.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Look at the hydroelectric scheme, exactly, the Snowy Mountains. That would never have been built without the thousands. We'd lost a whole generation of men. Tragic in itself, but no labour.
Yeah.
No labour force. It was all imported. And, of course, that was the first seeds of multiculturalism sown in this country, at Snowy.
So there are complications that come up with writing contemporary novels. Things change.
Yeah. But you see, that's it, isn't it, though, John? I mean, we are actually, a couple of people have said, but you write usually in the past. It's not altogether true, actually. As I said, Spirits of the Gan was relatively new, and it wasn't a previous generation. But why did you choose to write currently, you know? Well, because actually, what we're going through today is tomorrow's history.
Yeah.
I'm already writing historically, except it just happens to be current.
Well, this has been going on in the Australian scene. This has been going on since, in Vietnam, the boat people then, and then it all came back out in the Howard years. So, it's, you know, there's been rolling generations of people who experienced this kind of arrival.
Absolutely.
In Australia. So you sort of got an echo in the subject itself. I'm interested in the process, and I think I may bore some of our podcast listeners with my interest. But there are writers out there who love to know this kind of process. And you talk about the research. This is a 2-year process. But how far was the stay overnight, and this book being in our hands today? How long ago was that?
It'd have to be about 5 years ago. I wrote Spirits of the Gan in between. Following that trip to the Abrolhos, where I stayed overnight. So the seeds of that were already there as, one day could... No, it won't. Did Spirits of the Gan, because there was another inspirational thing that triggered that. So I wrote Spirits of the Gan. And then this came back. I'm thinking about where my next novel is going to be set. Yeah. And I just went, no, bite the bullet, do it. Bite the bullet, Jude, do it.
And you don't start like you, because we had a chat with Fiona McIntosh the other day, and she blew my mind with this 3-book thing that she has. She never stops writing. So even if she writes a draft, she'll leave it for 6 weeks, but she'll start another book in the space.
Yeah.
I did my head in. I was going, how do you keep that?
And such a beaut bird too. We've met briefly and done a gig together ages ago, and she's great fun. But no, I'm lost in admiration. I've heard a number of writers say they're working on 3 projects at once. Yeah. I certainly couldn't do it. As a matter of fact, I'm so, obsessed. By the where I'm at with the book that I'm writing. I don't even read other people's novels at all while I'm writing my own. I'm always reading for research, of course. Yes. I'm reading research books even as I go along, despite the pre-research and the field research that I do before starting. But I love reading with a passion. I can't put myself into that third world. I'm living in my real world. I've got the other world that is getting realer and realer to me by the minute. To get involved in a book, which again becomes very real for me, I don't want to be in 3 worlds at once. But I've read so many writers that it's the way they fire their brain up to have 3 projects going at once.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm lost in admiration.
So has there ever been a time when you've come out with a new book, you handed it in, and then you go on an orgy of reading.
I do. Enjoying yourself. Absolutely.
And then there's the it looks like a distant deadline, because you've got the 2 years, but has there ever been a point where you've gone, oh, I have to come up with something new, and I haven't got anything? Because this time you had something in the back of your mind, and you sort of, has there been times when you've had that big road out front, and you've just gone, uh-oh?
I think only once, and look, am I fibbing or not? I think it may have been this time. I think after I'd finished Spirits of the Gan, I was a bit lost, thinking, well, yeah, now I did my feast of my orgy of reading of the fiction I'd been longing to read for so long, and then I have a Christmas break, and then come, late January usually, I'm starting research on something that I already knew was in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
And that's when back came the Abrolhos.
Yeah.
And I thought, look, you always were attracted to that. Just remember that. And do it. So I think that's probably the only time when I was lost and wanted. And then it became a great thrill and a challenge, because I thought, you haven't done this before. You haven't done the really contemporary and on a very, as you say, both controversial and what was the gorgeous adjective you used? It was much better than mine. But a very confronting,
yeah.
A very confronting topic that will... It's a daily conversational topic amongst all Australians, I think.
I'm sure there are readers who agree with me that there are sometimes in us the desire for you to return to certain books and families and stories. Do you ever have that temptation to go back and to? I mean, there's so much going on in the Spirits of the Gan. There's so much going on in Ilion. You've got a well there that gave you great.
To do a sequel
or a spin-off or something. There are characters that wander through the book that could wander off and take you somewhere completely different.
No, but there is one beautiful fun story that I like to tell. It was when I wrote Cal, a story set in Kalgoorlie, gold mining town of Western Australia, of course. And it's the biggest vein of gold in the world. And, I mean, now it's like, a lunar landscape. It's deep, deep, deep open-cut mining. But this is post-World War I, and the diggers come home from World War I, and the Italians all have their jobs. So there's like a race riot in Kalgoorlie. And that's basically the... Well, the book ends. It does go through a couple of generations. This girl... who's become quite a character of the new generation, is leaving Cal, born in Cal and everything like that, and she's going to Perth and everything, and she's just looking out the window and she's seeing the Kalgoorlie, Perth-Kalgoorlie pipeline, the Coolgardie pipeline, and knowing that Cal will be an ever-surviving gold mining city as opposed to becoming a ghost city like so many gold mining towns do, because the gold is always there. They've just got to dig deeper and have more money to get there. And so this is Cal ends up being the hero of it, and she's watching this pipeline. Her name is Becky, And I thought, right, leave it there. I was going to go on further. It was going to become open cut mining and everything. This is the end of World War One. So I skipped out a couple of generations. I decided the book had wanted to stop there. Yeah. I wanted to stop it there. And that was it. I've had so many queries. Well, what happened to Becky? When's, you know, and I had one, this is the funny one, I had a fan mail in the days when people wrote, you know, pencil, pen on paper. And I got this letter and this woman said, I thought Carl was the best book I'd ever read. She said, I couldn't put it down. I loved it until I got to the very end. Then I wanted to rip it in pieces and throw it out the window. Oh. She said, I had the feeling that it had been a lovely sunny afternoon and somebody had knocked on your front door and said, do you want to come for a swim? And you'd said, oh, yeah, hang on, I'll just finish this book. Isn't that a gorgeous letter?
Yeah.
Isn't it a gorgeous letter? That wasn't the way I went.
No.
It wasn't that, oh, look, I'm getting bored and I want to get away from here. Yeah. Not at all. But that I just wanted to leave it at the perennial thing of Carl.
I disappointed people.
You've got to
do that. I mean, you've got to have people going, I want more. That's how you got to leave them, right?
I don't want her to feel she has to rip the book in half.
No, that's a bit aggressive. But you know, it's that feeling where you're so involved with a story. Yeah. And some of these stories where writers will often just drop in, you know, and do a segment of all these people's lives and then drop and leave again. And hopefully if you're a good writer, then it exists outside of your story, that things are out there. And so that reaction is perfect.
It is, because I must say, when I'm getting towards the end of a book, say, you know, 50 pages to go or something, I slow down, if I'm loving it. I just don't want to leave that world of those characters. So I know exactly what she meant. And another thing that somebody said to me, it was at a book club, and many publishers these days are putting at the end of the book the chapter of one of the backlist or the previous book. You know, in other words, if you've liked this new book, this is another one of Judy Nunn's or Fiona's or, you know, whoever. And somebody said, and quite rightfully so, she said, I didn't realise I was getting towards the end of the book.
Yeah.
She said, I thought I had another, you know, 60 pages to go. And so I did suggest, I said, why don't you put a big black line or something that shows that this is... I thought that was a very valid comment.
Yeah, definitely, because I've felt cheated when I've had something like that. I'm so emotionally ready for the end, and I'm pacing myself, and then it just stops. And it's like, oh, no.
Yeah, terrifying.
Judy, thank you very much for coming and talking to us. I could talk to you forever. We can go right through.
I could talk to you forever too. That's fun.
So much to talk about. Your new book, it will be one of our big, big titles for Christmas. And I'm sure everyone out there is desperately waiting to get a copy in their hands. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Always fun.
All of Judy Nunn's books are available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.